Hi, and welcome to the Green MBA podcast. I'm your host, Tia Collings. On this podcast, we chat with experts to help you on your journey to crafting more sustainable businesses and shine some light on how to keep people, profit, and planet front and center. Welcome to episode 7. In this episode, I chat with Gunter Pauli. Now, if you haven't heard of Gunter Pauli, he's a little bit of a legend of mine, so it was amazing to be able to get the opportunity to interview him. He is the author of over 40 books, so very busy man, including one of my favorites, The Blue Economy. Now, this book sets out to question what we currently think about sustainability or the green movement and challenges us to do more. But what I really love about it is it's not just from a theoretical point of view. He actually uses real life examples that he backs and that they go out and test to show better ways of doing things that can have a bigger impact. He's also an economist, a serial entrepreneur, fluent in 7 languages, and the founder of ZERI, which stands for Zero Emissions Research Initiative. And he also recently won the 2021 GOE Peace Award, and this was for his contribution to society and sustainability, both in terms of research and public awareness that he's been able to raise, helping to articulate a vision and a direction for us all to look towards for the future. Today's podcast is brought to you by Ecology. On this podcast, we only partner with businesses that we really believe in, and Ecology is one that I personally really love and use every month. Ecology helps businesses and individuals take action on the climate crisis by funding climate solutions and planting trees. To date, Ecology has planted over 16 million trees and reduced over 430,000 tons of CO2 emissions. It's super easy to set up, and for businesses listening, if you've ever thought about becoming carbon neutral, planting a tree for every sale, or inspiring your employees by investing in climate initiatives, then head over to www.ecology.com/business. That's ecology with an I at the end to get started. For individuals listening, you can also get involved by setting up your own profile and reducing your carbon for as little as 16 AUD a month. This is something I've personally done with my family so my kids can actually visually watch our forest grow, and it's something that they feel really proud of because they can actually see the impact they're making. So, if you're interested, head over to www.ecology.com. That's ecology with an I at the end to get started.
Welcome, Gunter, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Tia. Finally, it worked.
Finally, yes. For people listening, Gunter and I have been trying to connect for a little bit, and Gunter is actually giving up his time on a Saturday to be with us today and to share his learnings and experience building amazing business models and so much more. So my first question is to you, what got you started? Because you have done so much. What was the spark behind all of this?
A dream. I mean, there's nothing more than a dream. I mean, if you are a young person and you go from high school to university, you travel a little bit of the world, and then, you know, you have to have a dream, you know, you have life before you, and you say, what am I going to do to change the world? And that's the spark, is believing. And of course, if no one else believes in you that you can do it, starting with your mom and starting with your dear friends and so on, well, then you will never gather probably the energy and the belief in yourself you can do it. But it's simple. It starts with a dream.
And I think you must have started with a pretty big dream because you have achieved so much. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, which I think you're probably most famous for, is this idea, the Blue Economy, which was the book that you wrote. And one thing that I was looking at for this interview was the difference that you point out between the green economy and the blue economy. Can you explain that?
Well, Tia, I've been fighting for the green economy for 30 years. I mean, of course I wanted to have a green economy, and I'm trained as an economist. So I look at how can we have the competitive edge with green? How can we succeed in, you know, transforming the mindset of the consumer, the buyers of the supermarkets? And then the shock came to me because, you know, I did build a detergents industry. I did develop the first ecological factory with zero waste and zero emissions in 1991. And I did realize that just having biodegradable products is not yet giving you sustainability. So fighting as an entrepreneur and as an innovator, I one day woke up and said, but how is it possible? We have an economy where the green economy is tiny, teeny weeny. It's so small, but everything in the green economy is expensive. So if I have an economy where the good for you and the good for the environment is expensive, we got the wrong economy. I mean, this can't be true. So it's the economy for the rich. So being sustainable is for the rich. So the poor, those who cannot afford, those who are aspiring to the middle class, do not have access to things, products that are good for you and good for the environment. I said, shove it, no more. I mean, this model failed. And it's not because it's bad, but it's because we have to do much better. And so the switch of saying it can't be that green is expensive and therefore for the rich and therefore it will never be mainstream. And second is, I don't want to criticize what we have achieved until now. Let's move on and do much better. And the much better is the competitive model. Come on, Tia. We compete on the basis of being the cheapest. Now, if I have to be the cheapest and I have Bangladesh, I have Brazil face to face with me, and I got to be cheap, I better cut some corners on the tax payments. I better don't take care of the environment. I better don't do the social stuff in a great way, because I will never be able to compete on the basis of price. So the blue economy says no more competition on price. We are going to compete on the basis of value. How much do I bring you? What is it worth to you? And of course, the model cannot be that you compare one product with another product. You have to have one product that must now compare with five products. People say, how is it possible? No, it's very simple. I have my cup of coffee in the morning. My waste of my coffee turns into a mushroom. Oh, you can grow mushrooms and coffee? Yes, I can grow mushrooms and coffee. And we got 5,000 companies already doing it around the world, including in Sydney. And can I now use the waste of the coffee, which is the waste of the mushrooms, to feed the chickens? Yes, because it's full of rich protein, mushroom protein, coffee proteins. And so I have my cup of coffee, I got my mushrooms, I got my chickens, I got my eggs, and now I'm producing so many mushrooms I can't eat them anymore, so I can start producing a veggie burger. So all of a sudden I got five products. What am I competing with? With a cup of coffee? No, I mean, there's no competition anymore. I create so much value that this whole obsession of being the cheapest becomes irrelevant. That's the blue economy.
Yeah. And I think this is starting to come to life a lot with things like the circular economy as well, where we're not having any waste anymore. But when I read the blue economy, it was like the lights went on and I thought, oh my God, there's so much value that we are missing out on that we're just sort of throwing away. As you said, those coffee beans go in the bin. And I think you recently wrote a book, The Coffee Solution. So I love the example that you gave, because coffee also has a lot of social problems as well at the growing phase.
Yeah, I was just trying to look for where is the coffee. Here is the Coffee Solutions book. Sorry about that. Here it is.
Fantastic. I can't wait to get my hands on this and read it. I will share a link with people as well in the show notes to get one.
You know, if we look at the coffee model, and I'm going to be very blunt, how do we explain that we have an economic model for coffee where one guy, endorsing one brand earns more money than all the coffee farmers who supply that brand coffee? Excuse me, Tia, something went wrong there. I mean, I love George Clooney. I think he's a great guy. I adore his wife and the work she's doing. But come on, don't tell me he can earn 150 million where the farmers are not earning that amount of money. This is insane. this model must go bust, because this is no possible explanation to anyone, anytime, that that's how you do marketing these days. I mean, scrap the course in marketing now and say, if this is marketing, I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to do it differently. And this is where, you know, in my book, The Blue Economy, I said, we don't need masters of business administration. We need the masters of this beautiful adaptation to what nature is offering you, what we can be inspired by, how ecosystems function. And this shift in thinking, we have now put into more than 200 products and processes around the world. And don't tell me it's difficult and can't compete. If you say you can't compete and can't do the business, it's because your mind is not just in a tunnel. Your mind is in a tunnel. There's a train coming right at you. I mean, there is no, the light in the tunnel is coming right at you. And this is the challenge that we have today. How can we turn the machinery of the MBAs with 1 million diplomas sold every year, sold, because they're not for free. MBAs are not free courses. So how can we have 1 million sold MBAs transformed in what you call the green MBA? I would call it the blue one, but the color doesn't make any difference. The most important TA is, are we going to do it? Yes or no? Now, let me shift to another discipline, not just the MBAs. Let's talk about engineering, chemical engineers. So we have this massive problem of plastics in the ocean, and we have this huge overload of microplastics that are permeating our air, our soil. Everything is getting the microplastics. And then we have to ask ourselves the question, what are they teaching those kids who graduate from engineering school? Well, guess what? Chemical engineers, not only in Australia, around the world, chemical engineers never learn how to make a molecule, a polymer, a plastic. They never learn how to make a polymer that degrades in the soil, in the sun, and in the sea. Now, if no one teaches you how to make a polymer that degrades in the soil, the sun, and the sea, well, of course you're going to have microplastics everywhere. So I have now been calling for more than a decade. Which university will be the first university that obliges every chemical engineering student first year to learn how to put together a molecule that degrades in the soil, the sun, and the sea? It's not difficult, right? But we have companies doing it. But when we get a chemical engineer, we have to train them for 2 years to unlearn what they learned. So education, TM, becomes a critical component. And I, of course, I can't sit still. So I wrote another book called Plastic Solutions. You know, we need to get the solutions in place because it's not difficult. But if the basic schooling system doesn't teach it, in that case, we're stuck with a generation that will not be able to innovate and really fundamentally change the way we eat, sleep, and live.
I agree. And economics is something that also hasn't changed, and how we look at our economy. And I love the way that you are approaching it, and you're a million miles an hour, because I didn't know that you had done Plastic Solutions as well. So that's really, really exciting. You've written so many books. But when I was reading The Blue Economy, some of the things that really struck me that made me kind of stop and think, wait, how does that work? And one of them was use physics over chemistry, which I really love that principle, because we've created a lot of problems through chemistry. Not to say there's also a lot of solutions in that field as well. But the other one was create something out of nothing, which made no sense to me the first time, I have to say. Can you explain this and some models that actually deliver this?
Yeah. You know, the principles of physics over chemistry are very important. You know, I'm an entrepreneur. I build factories. I operate factories. And there is something that is called risk. You know, it's very important. You have to assess your risk. And risks means how predictable is it what you're doing? You know, are you sure that you will always get the same results? Yes or no? So if you want to be sure you always get the same results, you have to use physics, because physics is predictable. I mean, the beauty of physics is that, you know, well, this apple never goes flying. You know, it does go down from the tree. And, you know, there may be a very heavy wind. It may just move a couple meters left or right, but the apple does fall down. Hot air rises, doesn't go down. It's beautiful. You know, it's so predictable. So whatever you've learned as laws of physics, it doesn't change over time. There's very little of the basics of physics. Yes, there is quantum physics, and yes, there is microfluids, but these are on the fringes. The basic laws are always there. So I ask myself, how can you ever design an air conditioning system whereby you're pumping up cold air? I mean, excuse me, this can never be energy friendly, because if you're pumping up cold air, you need a lot of pumps, because cold air goes down and the hot air goes up. And of course, that's where you immediately see the beauty of the termite mound, where they have created those tiny little tunnels. And these are just termites, and we hate them. We exterminate them with a lot of pleasure because they are eating up our houses. But then the termite is able, wherever in the world they are, to always have the same temperature inside their nest, wherever they are. And that's fascinating. And they're using the laws of physics, and it always works. So what I think is important, that we stop using the chemistry. And now, what are we using the chemistry? Well, we need insulation materials, and insulation materials are full of chemicals. I mean, these are full of greenhouse gases. And then the question is, why do we insulate on the inside? Why don't we take the heat off on the outside? And this is what we've been doing with double roofs. So you have a roof and it gets hot, the top one, and then we have air going in between. And since the air goes up, the air will get warmer and warmer and will always slide through your roof, meaning that your roof keeps cold instead of you having to do it with polyurethane or glass fiber, which are toxic for your health and the environment. So what I'm seeing is there are these multiple uses of physics that have an immediate impact. Take from industry the demineralization of water. When you have water and the water is hard, you need to take the hardness out. How do we do that? Chemicals. Yeah, chemicals. Well, in nature, how does nature do it? Well, nature has a vortex. And the vortex, the swirling movement of water, increases the pressure in the funnel, and it pressures all solids out. We have now the first brewery in the world in the Netherlands, where there is no more chemistry used, which is actually not a good idea. When you make beer, you use chemistry to prepare the water. So the beer is actually made with water, where the pressure inside, which is physics, presses all solids out. And that's the way it works in nature. You know what you need? You need a column, and you need law of gravity. And as long as you understand the law of gravity, you can do it. So I can entertain you for hours more, Tia, on all the different applications we have for this simple thing called the laws of physics. And you know, this is where we have missed the opportunity to have predictability. Now, small detail, talking not to the MBAs, but again to the engineers, I'm saying that I got no moving parts. If you have no moving parts, guess what happens? No maintenance, no breakdowns. Oh, that's great for industry, because that means we're very viable and we're cost efficient. I mean, any industry that has moving parts, nothing you do about it. If you have moving parts, they will break down, because there's a law of friction. So I think if you put it all together, we can re-engineer most of the workspace, most of the shop floor, the factory floor. Now, your second question relates to this making something out of nothing. You know, there is not only waste. So the circular economy looks a lot at the waste streams we have. That has been going on for 40 years. Circular economy is a recent rebranding by McKinsey of something that used to be called industrial symbiosis. It's exactly the same. It existed, it's been implemented. But, you know, these McKinsey guys, they want to have great fees to be charged. So they need to invent something. So they create an institute and they make it well known and put the publicity behind it. And everyone is now doing circular economy. Well, the industrial symbiosis is exactly the same. But that is working. And that's great that you work with waste streams and you keep on recycling. But there are many resources that we have and we never use them. For example, we have a chemical industry, biochemical industry. The company is called Novamont. It is not a dream, it's a reality. And we look at thistles, you know, cardoon. We consider thistles a weed. I mean, it is the national flower of the Scots. It is the flower of the city of Nancy in France because it's beautifully purple, but it's so prickly that even the cows don't eat it. So we have started classifying thistles as a weed. And a weed, you throw on glyphosates, you know, you throw on chemicals to kill it. But this is actually a cost and this is a negative. We use today the flower, which is an artichoke family, we press out the oil and we turn that into an acid, which is the basis of our bioplastic. So we make a bioplastic out of a weed. It's like magic, isn't it? I mean, it's like, what? Out of a weed, you make a bioplastic. Yes, and we compete. And we compete because we're turning, the bioplastics are basically two ingredients. You need an oil that turns into an acid. And you need a sugar that turns into an alcohol. Alcohol plus acid is a monomer. Many monomers together is a polymer, demystifying plastics. So if I have sugarcane, and I have, which you shouldn't be eating anymore, and I have a vegetable oil that does not compete with food, then basically out of nothing, I'm creating something that is now out-competing traditional plastics. So it is the capacity to see something which has been considered as not even worth considering. And you take it, you turn it around, and you generate a whole economy around it. So you create something out of nothing.
Which is so amazing. And actually the fact that that grows in local areas brings me to the next point that you always say, source locally. Look at what's around you and use that as an input. And a thistle, I mean, it is a great example of that, at looking at something that is often discarded or looked over as well. Do you think COVID has had an impact on people now starting to do that a bit more and look locally about what they can create?
Some, but it's the exception. Some, not all of them. But what I work a lot in Italy, and when people were asked, what would you like to have now? You know, because they've been deprived of so many of their liberties. I mean, the constitutional rights were shattered by a few politicians who think they're making the right decisions. And I'm not going to judge them on that. But what we did find out after 12 months of all different types of confinement and restrictions and attacks on liberties, what most people in Italy liked was a nice, fresh meal made from the local harvest. And maybe this is Italians. Maybe, you know, the Italians love this kind of approach. But 71%, number one request was, I'm sick and tired of this home delivery food. I'm sick and tired of not being able to go to the stores and get my fresh veggies and my fresh potatoes and my nicely aged Parmigiano cheese. I don't want it to be wrapped in this plastics. We want fresh food. And so here is the development. When you look at fresh food, then we ask the second question and, oh, and by the way, would you like it to be organic? And people said, oh, yes, please, organic. Because, you know, they, all the food they've been eating has these long lists of additives. And of course, since people were at home and confined, for the first time, they were reading what's in these, in the, in this food I'm eating. And many people discovered that there's a lot of things in there they have never heard the name before. And so, yes, give me the organic food. Now, we made a calculation. If we were to satisfy the Italians' expressed desire to have organic food as the pleasure after having been confined, then we needed 800,000 hectares of land.
What is that in like a comparison? How big is that?
Oh, that's 2.4 million acres.
Wow.
2.4 needs to go organic because people say, we want to finally eat nice, fresh, local, and organic. We don't want the chemicals. And if we do it locally, we can do it. Now, just to say that 2.4 million acres is a lot of space. I mean, you just don't have it laying around and it's just not organic. But this has created a very strong movement build up by consumer demand to go organic. And do you know in Italy the movement called slow food?
I've heard of slow food. I don't know a lot about it though.
Okay, so slow food, as you can imagine, is the opposite to fast food. You know, it really is enjoying the food and part of it is take time to cook. And of course, if you're confined, you should take time to cook and not just call home delivery. But then you have to have the nice ingredients. So we see that probably in the food business, there has been a very interesting development. But here is a new product. We've just put it on the market. It's called DD&D. DD&D stands for Daily Doses for Natural Disinfection. I can't make you smell it, but I can show you the ingredients. And what we're using, sorry, this is in French, Tia, but we're using beetroots. You know, every year, the farmers will throw tons of beetroots on the freeway because the government doesn't pay them the money. So we're saying beetroots are sugar. Sugar is alcohol. Alcohol is the preferred disinfectant. We have rapeseed oil. We have anise. We have sunflowers. We have birches. And then we're adding some wonderful essential oil from neroli. The neroli, which is the flower of the oranges. So here you have a product that is 100% locally made. All comes from France, except the neroli. Everything is locally made. We realize that those hydroalcoholic gels you put in your hands are made from the same petroleum that goes into your car, if you're not driving electric yet. I mean, it's a bit more purified, of course. I mean, it's not as dirty, but it's a bit more purified. And then they put the gel in there, and the gel is acrylic. Acrylic. We have the biggest onslaught of microplastics in history in our water systems because we're using these hydroalcoholic gels made with microplastics. It's the same acrylic that is put into a diaper. So, you know, we want nappies to be dry so the baby doesn't feel cold. And, you know, so we can use the nappy a little bit longer. That's what we think. And so what we did is we put in acrylic. We put in a chemical that absorbs the moisture. Now, the same one that we put in the diaper, now we put in our hands. And according to the specifications, you should wash your hands after having put acrylic on your hands. We don't wash our hands because we just disinfect it. You see how stupid we get, how blind we get. And of course, the business is great. If I pay the farmers of the beetroots the same price as the chemical companies are getting today for their famous hydroalcoholic gels, then I can pay the farmers $6,500 per ton. Today, the poor farmer is getting 80. 80. So you see, once you start getting into it and you start unraveling, what do we find? We don't find trouble. We find opportunities. We find massive opportunities. And so this one is made out of glass. I'm not going to do this in plastics. I mean, I think when you buy perfume, Tia, you're not going to buy it in a plastic bottle, because you know that perfumes in plastics is just not the right thing to do. So we use glass and we make it solid glass so it can fall on the floor. And it's a roll-on, also made out of glass. And the side is made out of a rubber, natural rubber. So you can take it off, refill it. But you get this wonderful smell. And then you realize that instead of releasing in 10 milliliters, which is your daily dose of disinfectant, in 10 milliliters, you would normally release about 4 billion microplastics.
Wow.
4 billion. Now, welcome to the world of ignorance, because we are ignorant. And so this is why we need to have what you call the green MBA, what you know we would call the blue one. We need people to realize so many opportunities to just change it around overnight. This took us 2 months to get designed and produced. 2 months. Why only 2 months? Because it's easy.
I had no idea that what was in the hand gels was plastic. I have to say I was totally unaware. So that just really blew my mind, because, oh my God, we're using so much of that. That's crazy.
If you don't take it off your hands, you're going into your eyes. You may take it on your thumbs. You may even be tempted to go into your nose when no one is watching. And all of a sudden, you're distributing microplastics throughout your body. And this is where, you know, I often get the question, what is holding us back of doing this, of doing more of this? And Tia, the only thing that holds us back is ignorance. We're ignorant. We just don't know. And This is the age of the internet. This is the age of data mining. This is the age of everything available on Wikipedia. And we didn't know that they were putting plastics into these gels. No, the original design wasn't plastics. The original design was with seaweed, some carrageenan from seaweeds. But of course, the industry said that's too expensive. We got to do cheaper. And doing cheaper means cutting corners. And cutting corners means nature pays the bill. And we pay the bill as well.
There's so many examples that you've given during this talk, and you said 200 that you have as well. I mean, how do you come up with these? I mean, for people listening that are thinking, oh my God, this is amazing, all these different business models and ideas, is there a process that you go to, or kind of a simple resource or way of thinking or principles that you just stay by to come up with these?
So the beauty is when you write books and you expose yourself, people criticize, people react, people are unhappy, people say, I got something better. And so every day I receive at least 20 to 30 messages of people saying, I know something that will change the world. And then I look at it. And so fortunately, I have this huge network of scientists. And when I look at it, after one line, I know it's delete and say thank you, or I know that, oh, this is onto something. So usually, one out of 50 goes to the scientists. And then the scientists have a look at it and say, oh, well, is this really? Because I'm not a scientist. My mind is business. How do we turn it into a competitive business model? And so when I submit it to the scientists and the scientists come back and say, hey, that guy has this new way of taking nanoplastics out of the water, we think he's onto something interesting. And if only one of my scientists says this is interesting, I'm on a plane, I'm going to see the guy, I'm going to see the lady, I'm going to go, because I need to know, I need to see. And the result is that we have about 10 projects a year where we really are finding extraordinary breakthroughs. And that's how it works. The world works because we listen. And we listen, and then it triggers in our mind something inspiring, or it doesn't. I'm doing that for more than 30 years. So I've seen quite a few proposals where people say, I'm going to change the world. And they definitely have all the best of intentions. But we need to go to the proposals that will change the world fast. And this is why I try now to expose more people to what can you do with coffee? I mean, this red thing, this is the best antioxidant in the world, and we throw it away with the chemicals we use. And so it doesn't make sense. So if we go organic, we will have an overdose of antioxidants in our society. Now, that's new. We thought we have to go for kale and goji berries and turmeric to get our antioxidants. And all of a sudden, we realize that the best part of the coffee cherry is thrown away and has 10 times more antioxidants than goji berries ever had. So ignorance, Tia, is our biggest obstacle.
Yep. How do we all find out more? What is one of those ideas that has really excited you that you're excited to see make an impact in the future?
The biggest recent idea, and we're working very, very hard on it, is this: how do we take nanoplastics out of the water and make money with it? And you know, the technology of being able to take a nano, I mean, this is the size of cells. And this is the plastic that is killing us, because big pieces of Tetra Pak or big diapers floating in the ocean, you can pick it up, not pleasant, but you can pick it up and take it out. You can go for a Sunday morning plastic pickup on the beach in Manly, and you can find toothbrushes coming from Indonesia, but you pick it up and it's gone. But what is the problem are these tiny pieces of plastics that have withered down, where the molecules are intact, but they've just become very small. So a group of scientists came to me and said, we know how to take CO2 out of blood, just like the lungs do. I said, okay, the lungs do this very well. This is a case of biomimicry, right? This is biomimetics. You know, these lungs we have is 500 million little sponges that are connected to a couple trillion tiny little capillary veins. And when a little CO2 comes by, it's sucked out and we do, and it comes out of our lungs. Amazing, isn't it? But it works for 80 years without maintenance. And so it must be doing something really good. So I said, but guys, if you can do that with cells, can't you do that with nanoplastics? And I said, yeah, but we're in biomedicine. I mean, we're not in remediation technologies. I mean, that doesn't pay. 3 months later, they came back to me and said, oh, your proposal was an easy one. Taking nanoplastics out of seawater is so much easier than taking oxygen or cancer cells out of blood. I said, wow. So we immediately built a prototype. And they said, prototype? Well, it's a very easy prototype. It's just make an artificial lung, you know? I mean, that exists already. So here we go in 6 months' time, from an idea that pops up to a proven operational system. And now we're going to put it on our Parima boat. You know, we own this experimental boat that is made from carbon only, and that is operating on solar cells and hydrogen. So we are putting four of these units in there, and we realize we can process 200,000 tons of seawater per 24 hours, and that will clean maybe 30, 40 kilograms of nanoplastics out of the sea. Nano. Wow. And I must tell you, Tia, that gets me excited. Because now you're stuck with the nanoplastics, and it's nothing better than getting stuck with something and have to be creative. What am I going to do with this? Because you always have to think of the next step. And I think this is the next generation of entrepreneurs. It's not a core business with a core competence. It's entry into a market, and you keep on connecting, and you find always new opportunities. So the new opportunities is that we are building on our boat a pyrolysis system. And the pyrolysis will operate at 1,300 degrees Celsius. and we will make hydrogen from our nanoplastics, but we'll have destroyed them forever. And so even the fire retardants, even the ultraviolet blockers, even the phthalates, those horrible softeners we still put in diapers. It's forbidden in the suckers for babies, but we still put it in the diapers. So we take all the toxins out and we just simply destroy them, making hydrogen. And, you know, when you get into that kind of mode, then you feel you're changing the world.
That is a really exciting one. So what are you using the hydrogen for? Is that just to create energy?
That's our boat. Our boat runs on hydrogen.
Right. Okay.
We own the largest hydrogen boat in the world. We have transformed the logic. I mean, solar cells were great, but solar plus hydrogen is a wonderful option. Now, people say this is not cost effective. Excuse me. I got a cleanup of the ocean, which doesn't cost anything, because I'm using a new technique, which is called microfluids, and microfluids flow automatically. It's like blood flowing through your veins. If you were to have arteries like that, you need a big pump, and you will need a heart like that. But we got tiny veins and everything flows with capillary forces. So if you have tiny systems that flow with very little energy and no energy really to speak of, and I use something that's freely available, and I immediately transform that plastic into hydrogen at very high temperature, then you can't tell me this is not competitive. I mean, of course this is competitive, because what's my option? Having a nuclear power station there or a diesel generator? So very often we have the wrong logic in the right place. And the wrong logic is this, but petroleum is cheap. Yes, but if I don't have it, I'm on the ocean, I'm crossing the Atlantic, I'm crossing the Pacific, I'm using solar, I'm using wind, and I'm using seawater. And thanks to this, I can have all the energy I want and all the drinking water I want. What a message I'm bringing to every coastal community around the world. Look at Sydney with your water. I mean, come on. You know, water should not be made with membranes and reverse osmosis, and you shouldn't be doing a lot of things that we're doing, because it is not efficient. And it's not efficient because we do not know the opportunities of doing it with what we have.
I'd love to see that connected to cruise ships, because we had Bertie Stevens who I interviewed, and he said that cruise ships release the same CO2 emissions as 300 million cars a day just by being on the water, which blew my mind. So something like that, you just start to see the immediate impact and amazing power that has as well, also to take out the microplastics. That's really cool. So you put forward, I mean, the blue economy, the ideas of it, I think, were in 1994, before COP3. Is that right?
So what happened is that I had developed this crazy factory of with zero waste, zero emissions. I paid my workers to cycle to work. I actually came to Australia a few times, presented this new logic of doing business. But in 1993, in November, I came to Indonesia because I was the biggest buyer at the time of palm oil. And there I had the shock of my life, seeing that, you know, here I'm the guru for the green business next to Anita Roddick. And I had to admit I was destroying the rainforest. And so my frustration was to get out, and I needed to go through a full rethink and a full reset. And the Japanese government, when they got the mandate to organize the COP3 in 1997, I was invited to lead a think tank. And of course, I gotten out of this frustration of the destruction of the rainforest, the palm oil, the biodegradation, which was not at all sustainable. And so I was really ripe for something new. And when I was offered to lead the think tank to prepare for COP3, I thought it was a gift in my life. And so I went for it. And that's where a lot of the core ideas crystallized. as a philosophy, as a way of approaching. So I said, zero emissions is not an objective, it's the starting point. And of course, it was dismissed by our American friends, our European friends. The Japanese thought it was a great proposal, but you know, we never made it to COP3. I mean, we were dismissed. I mean, I made a presentation at COP3, but there were four people in the room, including me. And the other three were definitely in the wrong room because they had no interest to hear what is this all about. So I left frustrated and again, very unhappy. And then the message came to me, well, if the rest of the world isn't doing it, why don't you do it? And I said, okay, thank you. I'll get going. So the thinking process emerged when I launched the concept of zero emissions and zero waste in 89. I actually patented the term zero emissions. I released it in 1996 so that Toyota could use the ZE vehicle, the zero emission vehicle. I didn't want to get paid for that. I didn't want to get royalties on the term zero emissions. And so I released it and people started using. I was so pleased. 2 days ago, I saw that Procter & Gamble committed to zero emissions. I mean, wow, I mean, Procter & Gamble. Committing to zero emissions. You know, they even had some lawsuits against me at the time because I was doing for them unfair advertising. I mean, my advertising techniques were very unfair. I was comparing their product with my product. I shouldn't do that. And it's true, in European law, you shouldn't do that. In America, you can do it, but in Europe, you can't. So zero emissions emerged in 89. And now we have zero emission commitments, zero emission cities, cars. And I think this is where it came as a platform. And thanks to the frustration of no one wanting to listen, not even at the time, the famous Al Gore, not Bill Clinton, none of them were ready to listen to zero emissions. It didn't make sense to them. So having now had the opportunity to build it up over these nearly 30 years has given me a kind of a credibility to say that, hey, you guys, don't tell me it can't be done. It has been done. Now it's the time to have a new generation of entrepreneurs who will accelerate implementation. You know, with the mushroom farms, you know about that, Tia. The mushroom farms days is 5,000 farms around the world. And people say, Gunther, wow, that is great. And I'm saying, no, it has to be 1,000,000. I mean, I'm not going to put my head down until I have 1,000,000 of them because there is potential for 1,000,000. I can't be happy with 5,000. You see, we need acceleration today, an acceleration of the implementation of these projects with a clear local adaptation. We need to fit it into the local context and culture, and then we move on rapidly. And that is why my MBAs who work with me in the Master of Beautiful Adaptation, they are not allowed to use Excel spreadsheets and are not allowed to make business plans. I only allow them to write a business plan when they have their first invoice paid. No paid invoice, no business plan. Because you're learning, you're checking. And I don't want Excel spreadsheets. For us, Excel spreadsheets are prohibited. I don't want to see them. You know, once you have factories running, you can use a spreadsheet. But in order to get your business model in your mind, can't do that with a spreadsheet.
I love that. I'll put a link to that. Actually, I saw that on your website that you do teach that. So I guess we've come a long way, and I think everyone was quite shocked by the latest IPCC report. And now we've got COP26 in November. Do you think we're ready now to make some big commitments? Ideally, what would you like to see decided and actioned out of that?
Look, Tia, I have seen declarations. I was in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. And in 1992, you had this massive lineup of all these heads of state, 172 heads of state, all lined up, all committed. What have they done? Zero! Absolutely zero. So I am not interested in COP26. I was in COP1, 2, 3. And if I have 3 meetings well prepared over 3 years and I don't have results, stuff it, move on, do better. More of the same cannot get you better results. And then you have Australian governments and you have some other governments who are so conservative in their thinking we just have to forget about it, not fight it, not try to convince them. I'm not going to come to Australia to convince the prime minister he has to change his mind. I'm not doing that because he will not change his mind. And even if he pays lip service, he can't do it. I have a very basic way of explaining why it doesn't work. If you have a donkey and you want to teach the donkey to play the fiddle, I wish you good luck. And if you ever were able to have taught the donkey how to play the fiddle, the concert is not going to sound very nice. And this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to make these donkeys play the fiddle. They will never play the fiddle. And if they do, it's not going to have any impact. So stop talking to the donkeys. I mean, move on with the young entrepreneurs. Don't be as frustrated as our dear Greta is. You know, don't be frustrated and accuse and tell them you haven't done what you should have been doing and I don't know how to do. Tell your elders to say that, look, you got your chance, you goofed up, let me take over. And we have to have a generation that takes over. And of course, with ignorance and very bad education. And the first thing you have to do is shut down Google and you have to shut down Wikipedia because they give you the answers that everyone already knows. That's the problem. We're doing more of what we know. We have to start doing things we did not know. And that means you have to have a new generation ready to embrace adventure and risk. And if I look at the enormous popularity of extreme sports, it's because so many young people would love to take risk and want to do the adventure. But unfortunately, we send them off in the Yosemite Mountains or we send them off to the outbacks of Australia. And you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't put them into the adventures of business. And the adventures of business is where we will be creating completely new environments, completely new thoughts. And of course, all of these ventures that we're backing up have one characteristic: no apps, no applications for the computers, no internet stuff. We have enough of that. You get millions of apps to put in your Apple phone, and what has it done to the world? Everyone is looking at the phone. I mean, this is absurd. We need products that actually change the world because every day we can do it. And so that is where we're at.
And we do. We have some of the smartest people working on how to serve up ads and keep us on longer, which is kind of a waste of talent. And I think hopefully the tide is changing now. And so maybe it's got to come from the business community. So getting to the end of this now, I asked everyone the same question, and this is going to be a really interesting one for you because you sort of do teach an MBA of sorts. But I ask, if you were to teach an MBA, what would be your top 3 topics that you would include?
Oh, I would close the class. I would not permit anyone to come into the class, and I would ask them to go with me on 3 trips around the world. I mean, stop going to classes. Stop teaching. Start exposing people. And I would ask them, I would take them to the desert. I've done that. I'd take them to the Namib desert and say, now you design me a business model for food. Go to the Namib desert and think about how you're going to create an abundance of food. And people say, you're crazy. It's desert. Well, that's where we need creative people for. I mean, don't think about planting the trees that one day will cover the desert, and because you've gone 20 years and you will be out of budget and you will be bankrupt before you ever can get the first harvest from your first tree. You got to think a bit faster. And so I teach how to eliminate burn rates in investments. I teach how to have multiple cash flows, not one cash flow, how to arrive at net accumulated positive cash flow in 1/3 of the time that the standard of the business is doing. And that's why I take young people who really are it's not an out-of-bound test of your perseverance of character and teamwork. It is see the opportunities where no one sees them. And to me, that's what the MBAs have to do. Lesson number one, see opportunities no one sees. Lesson number two, see opportunities no one sees. Lesson number three, see opportunities that no one sees. Because once you have your portfolio of things you see and you know that no one else is seeing, you will be a pathological entrepreneur and you'll be changing the world. And that's not what we're doing. We don't have to teach marketing, don't have to teach finance, don't have to teach human resources, organizational behavior. I have my MBA. I know the stuff they throw at you. I don't need any of that. I need to become a true entrepreneur with a heart and a soul and working for the common good.
I really like that. And getting out there into the real world and actually doing it, because otherwise we don't end up with much.
You have a bit of desert in Australia. I mean,
you have a slight bit of desert.
Yeah, and it's increasing a little bit, you know. So, I mean, it's very important. The beauty in business is you're able to adapt to ongoing changes. And this is really a mastery, because what we do in business too much is you make your plan, you execute your plan, you force everything to go in a military fashion until you have your majority of the market share. And we know that this is not the way we're going to turn the world sustainable. This is how we're going to continue pillage, rape, violate. We do the worst that we do, not because we want to, but because we are marching orders of the business plan. And therefore, we need to take a step back and let our heart talk and let our heart be inspired by nature and ecosystems.
And that brings me to my final question, which is, we hear a lot of negativity in the media about what's going on with climate change and obviously the pandemic. What's something that you're really, really positive about?
Well, first of all, shut it off. Turn off. Don't listen. I mean, the worst thing is that we're getting brainwashed. And in the end, we're convinced about everything, what they've been telling us now for 18 months. So first thing, turn off the radio, turn off the TV. Create your own shows like you're doing, Tia. That's the first step. The positive is that we have this innate capability to take action. I mean, we have to basically wake up the child that is still in us, a child that has no limitations in creativity, a child that can entertain itself for hours with a fly. The child with fascination looks at a butterfly. You know, a child is a child. We need to become child again and wake up that child in us. And when you woke it up, keep it alive. And that is fearless. I mean, that's why mom is always saying, don't touch, don't do, don't go. Don't you see? That's dangerous. You know, but a child is innately fearless. And we need to have that fearlessness back into us. And we need to get experimentation, trial, without any judgment. That must be possible again. You know, I remember very well when I proposed zero emissions, people said, it's not possible. It was not possible, zero emissions. And I was even being told that you can't live without making waste. If you don't go to the toilet at least a few times a day, you're a dead person. And I have always had this response of, it is not possible. That's not the way it is. And that is why what we need, and my positiveness in us can only wake up when we're permitting that little child in us to be awake. And that's the reason why, you know, half my time I spend on writing fables for children. I mean, children's stories are what inspires kids, because it takes us far away from, don't do this and be careful, watch out, it's time to go to bed. Children want to have that free world.
Yeah, I've got two kids myself, and it's hard not to be like, careful, don't do that, don't kill yourself. And because they do, they are innately curious about absolutely everything. My little one tried to eat a cockroach the other day, you know, too curious. But
cockroaches are not toxic.
I was horrified. She was fine. So where can people find out more about some of these business models? Where can they connect with you?
Just Google, you know, and there are many websites, many videos, many things, and just search and discover. And there are many ways to write me a message, like I think you did, and you will end up with one of my dear colleagues and assistants who will take immediate care of the immediate needs, and then we'll schedule more if more is needed.
Great. Thank you. Well, thank you so much again for taking this time on a Saturday. It's been amazing chatting to you, and very eye-opening. And I hope that people listening to this as well gain some amazing value from it.
Well, thank you, Tia.
Thanks for listening. I hope the audio was okay. We did have to use a different software, which did unfortunately affect the quality a little bit on this one. So I'm really sorry about that, guys. However, if you did like what you heard, please head over to iTunes and write a review. It would really mean the world to me, and it does help other people find the show as well. Thank you to Ray from America, who wrote 5 stars. If you want to deep dive into supply chains and hear from experts in the green niche, this pod is for you, a must listen. So thank you, Ray, for taking the time to write that. It's really fantastic to see people from the States also tuning in and enjoying the show. For more information about building sustainable businesses, you can connect with me on Instagram at TheGreenMBA or head over to our website for a deep dive, www.greenbusinessmba.com. A special shout out to Andy Johnson, who edits and produces the show. You can find out more about his work at tonalitymedia.com.